Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 21st of September. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And Charles Archer.
Is this the longest day of the year today? I think it is.
Is it actually? And what a week it's been.
21st of September. Yeah. Sunday.
What a week it's been. Some of the best roads I've ever driven in my life. I mean, literally, I think I sent a video to Charles. I did send a video to Charles saying, look at the views from up here. Furka Pass, St. Bernard Pass, the Suston Pass, some of the best hairpins, long sweeping roads. Managed to cook the brakes in the car, which was an interesting brown trouser moment. But yeah, what did you make of the views, Kev?
The views were incredible. I mean, the whole scenery and I ticked off two countries I've never visited as well.
Oh, yeah, Italy. You had lunch in Italy, didn't you?
On the same day, I was in France, Italy, Switzerland, and then subsequently Germany the next morning. So, yeah, I ticked off two countries I've never been to, Switzerland and Italy. Beautiful lunch in that small Italian town. That was fantastic. And going up and down those passes was, yeah, crazy, but just breathtaking. We saw Mom. We saw the Matterhorn as well in Switzerland, and yeah, amazing. Too much driving for me.
If you're not putting a 10-hour stint in each day, you ain't living.
Way too much. But there you go. It's horses.
It sounds like you kind of understand if you travel a bit around Europe, particularly if you're driving, why Americans think it's just one country. You know,
yeah.
Even the ones that have been to school, because like you can literally be. Because I used to live in the Dolomites in the Alps, you know, so not a million miles from where you guys were for a couple of years. And literally, you could pop into Switzerland, you know, jump across the border, you'd be in France, Spain, Monaco, it's Liechtenstein, it's all right there. Yeah, maybe the next time I'll come. Could be fun.
Charles going to buy a big fancy car.
I'm going to buy a big fancy car. Well, apparently that's the thing that you do when you make a bit of money. So a big fancy car.
We're going to do that this year. I reckon there's some money to be made, Charles, this year. How's the market?
Yeah, maybe next year. I don't know, relatively soon. Thing is, right, so like all the cool cars are used petrol and all the tax advantage cars, you lose electricity. That's the problem that we've got, right? So like, you can probably get like an electric Lamborghini for about £4 if you have like government incentives. But if you want to use petrol, then apparently you have to pay full whack. I don't know what that's about.
But Charles, this is not a logical financial decision.
It's a very logical financial decision. I want it.
Exactly. But... from the point of view of having any logic to what you have to pay for, there is no logic.
So it's got to be gold-plated is what I'm hearing.
Gold-plated or spot. Yeah, diamante. So anyway, let's have a look at some of the news stories that have dominated. I think there's really only one big headline buzzing around this week. Obviously, the presidential visit or state visit to the UK, obviously, ended up in Windsor, big state banquet there. And out of that, I guess one of the big positives came was this UK-US tech pact, which was obviously coincided with that visit. What do you make of that, this new investment there? That effectively, the deal is a commitment between the UK and the US to pump significant investment into AI, quantum computing and other high-tech infrastructure. You know, it's basically a pledge of around $42 billion or £31 billion dedicated to building out these kinds of cutting-edge capabilities. What do we make of that pact?
I think my first thought is that Keir Starmer seems to like be pretty rubbish at everything, but is very good at attracting investment into the UK. And I wonder whether maybe a career change, you know, a department move might be good for him. You know, it's billions and billions of dollars coming into a country. I think the most important thing is when you're talking about like building out AI data centers, is that, you know, the UK is one of the global leaders in AI data centers. And yet we've got the highest energy costs in the world. So why are those two? It basically means that even though the energy cost is so incredibly high, it's worth it just to be in the UK. And I think that, you know, well, obviously, US-UK kind of signing deals. These are private companies making these decisions as well. And it kind of goes to show that we talk ourselves down a lot in the UK in terms of the economy and what could go on, et cetera, et cetera. We're still one of the largest economies in the world. We've got very bright people. We've got Oxford. We've got Cambridge. If we had the, you know, capacity to build our tech sector properly without just sending out to the Americans every 5 minutes, we'd probably be rivaling the NASDAQ.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think really good news.
I think it was Jensen Huang, wasn't it, the CEO of Nvidia, who said that he described the situation in the UK as a Goldilocks circumstance. I think he said the conditions are right and there's enough momentum, talent, investment, but infrastructure needs catching up. So maybe that's what this new
Oh,
talent.
he said that the first £1 trillion company in the UK will be related to AI yesterday, right? He's probably not wrong. Man kind of knows AI better than anybody else, so we
Yeah.
shall see.
What do you make of the fanfare or the lack of fanfare around Trump visiting and the fact that they projected the Epstein video of him and Epstein together onto the side of the Windsor Castle?
Well, let's see. Trump's met with Xi, he's met with Putin. Global leaders meet with a lot of people they disagree with, a lot of people that, on a personal level, they might even hate, but that's not the point. The point is that you build connections between countries. And this is the key thing, right? Because you talk about like the special relationship between the UK and US and whether it actually is special or not. I think this kind of show, this has gone to show it is special. There is a special connection there. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that Trump is an old, potentially sick man. Whether he lasts his term of this presidency or not, he won't be president forever. Keir Starmer is unlikely to be in power in a few years, if we're being realistic. So you're building out a connection, a multi-decade connection that's already been going on for centuries. I think that's the most important thing. It's about keeping that relationship alive between the two countries.
And who wasn't invited to the state banquet? Did we see who wasn't invited?
Two of them. Nigel Farage, who was not particularly happy, and our wonderful Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who was
Sadiq
also
Khan.
not too happy. And to be honest, I imagine everybody had a much better time having either of them there. But
I think this is true. But our first guest today is actually the gentleman that you interviewed just a week or so ago, Charles, in Peter from Mast. And they had some spectacular news this week just about the AI data centers and the electricity that's going to be required for those. So,
Yeah, so let's move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by Peter Krugel, CEO of Mast Energy Developments. The company has just set out a bold strategy to deliver up to 1 gigawatt of power campuses across the UK over the next 3 years, aimed at supporting the surging demand from AI data centres. This comes as Google, BlackRock, and OpenAI announce billions of pounds of new investment into UK AI infrastructure, backed by the UK-US tech pact signed during President Trump's state visit, with Mast targeting 100 megawatts of shovel-ready sites within the next year and scaling from there. Peter is here to tell us how the company plans to position itself at the forefront of powering Britain's AI revolution. So, welcome back to the podcast, Peter.
thanks, Phil. Thanks, Kevin. Very good to be back. And yes, no, we are super excited about this new strategy of ours. It's something that we started crafting almost a year ago. So we saw this as a potential opportunity. And very interestingly, if you look back at the UK market, even a year ago, data centers were almost unheard of. So nobody considered this as an opportunity. We did. We looked at the US market. We expected that the same thing is going to happen here if certain things fell into place. That's exactly what's been happening now. This week alone has shown that the UK is very well positioned to become an AI superpower globally. It's being said that by the likes of NVIDIA CEO that he expects the UK to be the largest AI data center complex in Europe and globally, apart from the US as well, the largest. So there's significant growth opportunity here. And as an early mover and somebody that's seen this opportunity and started crafting a strategy, I think we're very well positioned to benefit from this.
Yeah, absolutely. So what does this kind of surge in this international investment, as I mentioned there, you've seen the likes of Google, BlackRock, and OpenAI putting up a significant investment. But what does it mean for Mast, and how might it look and affect its strategy to power these AI data centers?
Yes. So I think the first and foremost thing to remember is that we're not departing from our existing business model. In fact, this is just complementing and expediting our current business model and our growth targets. So we're deploying and applying the same solutions that we've proven now. And this is just a new source or a new strategy that's going to fast track that. So previously, the FlexGen market, there's been growth potential. That's expected to double over the next 5 to 10 years. So there's already scope for us there. But I mean, adding this to the mix, and the numbers are saying, and the expectations are that AI data center power demand is going to quadruple over the next 5 years, adding circa 6 gigawatt of power demand to the UK energy mix. That's a massive gap to fill. And there's already a shortfall between energy supply and energy demand in the UK. Already there's a shortfall. So this is just going to widen that shortfall. It broadens the demand gap for us to come in and fill. So I think it is a very attractive opportunity for us. We've got a solid strategy behind that opportunity now, and we're very confident and excited about the potential that this holds.
Yeah. So here you are, you've set this target of, I believe, 1 gigawatt in a period of 36 months. Can you talk us through how the modular rollout may look?
Yes, so one of the benefits of this strategy is that it is modular, and we can deploy at scale. So a typical data center complex in the UK is around 25 megawatt, starting at rolling up to 100, and there's also up to a gigawatt. So there's big scope there. But initially looking at the smaller projects just to get the strategy rolling, that's 25 megawatts. So if you do four projects, that's 100 megawatt right there. I mean, we're already in advanced discussions with the data center developer regarding specifically a first project. That's a 25 megawatt top tier data center development that's already got co-located power sites next to it. I mean, so that's kind of the ideal project for us. So hopefully, we'll conclude that transaction and then just duplicate that.
Yeah.
So we're very confident that we can build that first 100 megawatts within 12 months and just scale it from there.
Yeah. And obviously we've talked about in the past the likes of these big companies, Googles and BlackRocks, who do this, what they call hyperscaling. But how do you see yourself, the little minion of Mast? Would you be competing with those or maybe partnering with the likes of those aforementioned companies?
Yes, definitely partnering. We definitely see those partnerships. So typically what happens is a data center development starts with a single structure or single project at 25 megawatts that gets scaled sometimes on the same property to 100, and then that can become a campus of up to a gigawatt. And that also fits into the UK government's AI data center growth zones, the first of which has been announced. And what the growth zone essentially gives the developer and the owner is ease of the development process. So everything is set out, it's clear, it's fast-tracked, including planning consent, the grid and gas connections. So there's a clear pathway to get to shovel ready, to construct the campus and to go into commercial production. And I think because the UK government has established that also is one of the main reasons why we've now attracted the significant capital investment, all of which have been announced this week.
So, Peter, you must be pinching yourself because 14 months ago you're scrapping around hoping you survived, and now you've got the big seven companies in the world potentially coming to the UK saying, "We need your power, we need your power." Does that make you smile or cry?
Maybe a little of both, but yes, Kevin, you're 100% right, and I think we're at the right time, doing the right thing, already having a strategy, being an early mover. So, and I mean, all of those things are key to a recipe for success.
Yeah, I mean, what is interesting in the last RNS to me was that you've moved phases because you always had a phase one, which was, I think, get to 100 megawatts, then phase two, which is 300 megawatts. And now you've got a phase three in there, which has been slipped in, which now says 1,000 megawatts, i.e., a gigawatt. How big within 5 to 10 years could Mast become? I mean, where does it stop?
Yeah, exactly. And I think with this, with the AI data center sector now being a tangible reality in the UK, backed by, all these giant companies and the investments that they've announced, supported by the government with clear policy, I mean, the expectation already is that the power demand for that is going to reach 8 gigawatt by 2030. So in 5 years' time, that's probably going to double again 5 years thereafter. So there's massive scope for demand, and we're saying that We're targeting 1 gigawatt of that over the next few years. And you know, that's going to be a step in the process. As you say, where does this end? We don't know, but definitely not there. You know, we've got big ideas, big plans, and this is the first part of it. So
Yeah, I
we're
mean,
moving forward now.
the other interesting thing about these AI centers is they are going to need security of demand of electricity like no other business in the world, you know. So it's not just going to be to step in when, you know, you've got gas flowing. What happens if the gas stops? You know, you're going to have storage batteries on these places as
Yes.
well, for sure. Whether that's created from the gas turbine or from something else. I mean, so do you see that this plan would be, you know, you'd be able to go in, give the 25 megawatt supplied for the AI center and also batteries and maybe also even solar to help all of these situations? I don't know. Tell me more.
Yes, no, that's a very good point, Kevin, and that's exactly right. So we see a hybrid solution on the campus. So I think the backbone of the power solution would be gas, and our current low emissions gas turbine solution is ideal for that. It's been used globally successfully, and that'll be supported by battery energy storage solutions, BESS. I think in certain parts, solar could also be an option, but definitely a hybrid situation. So again, you know, the NVIDIA CEO in his interviews and press statements this week said that he sees the power solutions being hybrid, not only renewable because of the intermittency. And we know that our business model is based on exactly that, is renewable power or intermittent, and we need to fill that intermittency with flex gen, and that's exactly what we're good at.
Very good. So for shareholders, what would you like to say to them in terms of where you think Master's going to be?
What I can say at this stage is that we've made significant progress. We've got a clear strategy, and we're an early mover in a very exciting opportunity for the UK for the first time in a very long time. You know, let's be honest. You know, the UK is well positioned to become a superpower like they've been before in other areas, but it's been a while, you know, since the UK has been classed as a superpower on anything. But you know, so that's very exciting, and we plan to be a big part of that, to enable that to happen, and to make sure that it's sustainable. So yes, what I would say to shareholders is that it's a very exciting time, and we've got big plans. So watch this space.
Very good. We look forward to hearing from you in the not too distant future as these things come. I mean, for me, it's like a combination of AI and electricity. It's sort of like the AI utility AI play. And yeah, I think it's going to be exciting as we move forward.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Peter, thanks very much for appearing back on the roast.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to come back with some good news in a short while.
So our second guest this week is Charles Bray, Executive Chairman of Aterion. Aterion has just launched its expanded trading operations in Rwanda with the first shipment of responsibly sourced tantalum niobium concentrate already moving to its global trading partner. This marks a pivotal step as the company activates a compliant supply chain through its subsidiary East Inco, secures trade finance, and begins scaling up commercial sales. With demand for critical minerals like tantalum and niobium rising, Aterion is positioning itself as a key player in responsible sourcing and international distribution. Welcome back to the podcast, Charles. How's life?
It's great to be back. Thank you for having me, and life is good.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, just how significant is this first commercial consignment for Aterion, and what does it mean for the company's growth trajectory in Rwanda and beyond?
It's quite significant because this is what I describe as our first container. And that obtaining that sort of volume has taken a bit longer than we had anticipated, primarily due to some of our own traceability requirements. So we now have over 30 different compliant suppliers who we are visiting on a regular basis, checking in, making sure they maintain their compliance. Excuse me. And that is allowing us to have a regular supply in amounts that justify having a container being sent out every month. So that took a bit longer than expected. You've heard me say that before, but I'm going to be straight with you. So that was disappointing in terms of the time it took. Also, what we didn't expect was the capital, just how much capital it would require. But we were able to readily solve that with a small injection of capital from a couple existing shareholders in terms of mezzanine debt. And we're off and running. So now it's about growing it, as you mentioned. And so we're hoping to get to a couple containers supply per month in relatively short order.
Yeah, and presumably will operations then cover the cost of all, the working capital of the company going forward? Is that the plan?
Yes, and it should do that should be the case with just one container a month should cover everything except any exploration spend we might have. So once you get the two containers, then you're talking about being able to have some capital for exploration spend and getting on with the entire business, so to speak.
So, hallelujah. The trading is happening.
We're only 12, 14 months late.
Yeah, I think you've been generous to us. But anyway, we're looking at a situation now where hopefully most of the costs are covered within the business. You've got a 4 million market cap with assets that you've got a joint venture with a major. You've got some Kraken licenses in Botswana right in the middle of somebody spending a huge amount of money. And you've got some Kraken licenses in Morocco, silver, copper, and I think some gold chucked in there as well. So how on earth are you worth 4 million pounds?
We think a lot of it has to do with our failures with respect to marketing and not making the market aware of what we're doing, and also the regularity of our news flow. So we've had some made some changes internally. We've made some in changes at the individual level so that we're more regular in terms of providing the market with updates on what we're achieving, because we think that the market needs to understand, one, what it is we're actually out there doing, whether that's in Botswana, and we just made an announcement about two new licenses, or I'm sorry, three new licenses, two of which we're incredibly excited about. And so we want to get work done on those, and we want to make sure the market's receiving regular updates on how that work's going. As you mentioned, we have four licenses in Morocco that have tremendous potential. Two are relatively early stage, but the Agdez one in particular is a mining license, and we're starting to work on potentially having some development of that, again with another partner, but as well to expand on the drilling there. So we have a pretty extensive drill program that we're looking forward to announcing and getting started with relatively quickly.
Good. So the situation in Botswana, just tell the audience what is happening in terms of all of the licenses around the licenses that you're excited about. I mean, I know you've done some exploration on those, so again, I don't think you can, I don't know whether you have any results yet, but they'll maybe be coming. But again, tell us what your thoughts are on those.
In Botswana, we have had the good fortune of acquiring a series of licenses which were originally worked on by the group that eventually became the MMG Commensal license area. So that's the one that was acquired by MMG for 1.7, 1.8 billion US dollars. Originally, they had six or seven different areas that they were very excited about. You can go through the history of the licenses. Two of those areas we've ended up with. We understand why they were so excited, and it has to do with the nature of the sedimentary deposits and these particular folded areas that we were able to pick up on. And so from our standpoint, we are basically establishing what I would call the drill targets. It's going to take us a little bit of time to do that, but we have the ground physics, we have all that data, and we have the professional third-party professionals working on it. We're going to take that data and establish drill targets and get to drilling as quickly as we can. But it's very exciting because, historically, where you found these folded areas, you have found high concentrations of copper.
So you're going to sell one of these licenses for $1 billion, is what you're going to
That would take a little bit more work, but we're very interested in partnering with some people to advance these licenses quite substantially. And, we're not afraid to vend. And I think that is the other thing that the market will appreciate. If we were to sell something, I don't think they've seen us doing that yet. And there's been a reason. It's just simply we haven't found the right partner, the right price. That combination is very important to us. And we're just going to hold out to get something that's fair. Nothing more, nothing less.
So you could potentially be selling something, getting some cash, potentially maybe keeping a royalty or something if there is
exactly
something found in the future.
Yeah, maybe perhaps some payments based on reserve estimates plus a royalty and some cash up front. That's the sort of model we look at.
Very good. So just give us a bit of a background then on why Agdez or any of the others in Morocco could be game changers as well. I mean, yeah. I personally actually think that Botswana is going to be pretty big. I think you're going to get some real reward from those licenses. Because the old guy that you bought those off that is still with the company, there was a reason why he was keeping those licenses good.
The difference between Morocco and Botswana, and you've picked up on this, is that Botswana is much better known by the market. And so with these particular license areas, that's where the excitement comes from. It's not something that we have to introduce to a counterparty. Generally speaking, when we speak to people about Botswana, they understand the potential. They understand what's there. They know the particular area. They're looking for a license that has particular features. So it's pretty easy and simple to discuss. In Morocco, and what excites us so much about Agdez is that these are relatively unknown areas. And Agdez, from the drilling we've done in the past, the sampling we've done most recently, and we're just, you know, we're moving in some heavy equipment at the moment to start to dig some trenches and do some additional work, in addition to some drilling that's upcoming. We see the potential not just for copper, but also for silver and gold. And what we're discovering is that a lot of these particular areas are what I think the geologists describe as polymetallic, with lots of very, very substantial grades discovered in relatively small areas. So I think the best example and who we in Morocco try to model ourselves off of from the discovery standpoint, or at least this exploration phase, is Aya Gold and Silver. And so we've been able to visit some of their sites, talk to them about what they looked for. They've been very helpful and just super professional. And so we just think there's a tremendous amount of upside and the market just doesn't see it yet. So we're looking to prove that much in the way that I have proved it.
And the final one then is Rwanda. You know, you've got your joint venture with Rio.
Yes.
And, you know, what's the next stages in that? If they're not going to continue with them with you, then you've got a fantastic asset that we know that there is lithium now. If they are going to continue with you, then it's it's more progress can be made, but you'll be 100% owners of it. So what do you think is going to happen?
We still don't know, and I'm sorry not to be able to give you a firmer update. But since the last time we spoke, what we do know is that Rio Tinto, over the next 3 to 4 weeks, by mid-October, is anticipated to have internal discussions on which particular areas within Rwanda, if any, they want to proceed with. Again, our impression, this is purely an impression, and we're not speaking on their behalf in the slightest, is that they see this area, they see quite a bit of lithium of different with different characteristics, different grades, but more importantly, different quantums. And so we think they're trying to decide, you know, which mines, which particular sites they can take forward to create one that has enough scale for them. Or is it something where, you know, there's a lot of different areas that have decent small scale mining potential or even medium scale mining potential, but not big enough for them. So time will tell. But as you said, from our vantage point, we're very encouraged by the grade and the nature and more the nature of the deposit. And so we're keen to get drilling on that. And so we'll be discussing that with them over the next 3 to 4 weeks.
Well, they agreed to exercise their stage one earning rights under the JV agreement that you have. So, I mean, that's a strong indication. So, you know, earning, Yeah, that's 51% for license. And I want to talk quickly, about those grades and those lengths, because that highlight from hole two, 6.9 meters from 174.6, grading 2.11%, and then a higher grade interval of 3.45 meters at 3.2%. Over 2% lithium dilithium oxide is very high by most industry standards. Most hard rock lithium mines are averaging 1 to 1.5%. And that high grade core is obviously, stand out and excellent. The interval is narrow, but we are in an early stage, geological program. Rio Tinto obviously only wants to find tier one assets to develop for itself.
Yes.
You would think, given how effectively they put limited capital in, what you're looking for is something interesting enough for them to want to explore more.
Yes.
Now, if you had had the length, then they'd be rocketing ahead. At the moment, you only have the grade, but my perspective is, maybe you can comment on this, that grade is high enough to keep them interested at least until the end of the next stage, you would imagine.
Well, not necessarily to the end of the next stage. To again, I'm going to be very blunt with you guys, but definitely enough to establish the nature of the formation. When I speak internally to our geologists, they say that they suspect this is a pegmatite that has what they describe as it almost looks like a fingering, where you have the central body that would be the palm, and then you have these offshoots with these very high grades that they would describe as fingers. And so it's about establishing first the nature of the pegmatite and then the grades associated with that nature as the next step. And if that looks good, then definitely I can see them extending all the way through the full 5-year option.
And I guess
Does the palm of the hand have pegmatites in, or just the fingers?
we need to drill it.
Okay, so we don't know. Okay, I'm with you.
And the only way they can know is if they expend more money.
Yes.
And they'll probably want to know, but that's where the cookie crumbles.
The eggs. Here
In
we
between
go.
the lines.
And I suspect, well, I suspect that the nature of the pegmatite is not dissimilar to two or three others nearby.
And I'm assuming as well, I would guess, if Rio Tinto are, if they make a major discovery or even a mid-tier discovery based on this, they'll be wanting to snap up all the exploratory tenure nearby that's close by as well, that I
And they have
imagine.
that option with their agreement with the Rwandan government.
Beautiful. Okay. Wonderful.
Very good. Charles, we want to hear from you more often. We think this is
Yeah.
a good story.
I think that's the plan.
You
You
know,
will hear from us more often.
we've put our money where our mouth is as well in terms of investing in this. So yeah, I think it's a good one. From 4 million market cap, what you have, it doesn't really make a lot of sense at this moment in time. And I'm quite sure if someone came along and offered you even 8 million for all of these different options, you would probably
We'd have
not
to
accept
hesitate.
it. Yeah, you would not accept it, because ultimately it's worth significantly more. So yeah.
Agree. But thanks, gents, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Yep, thanks for coming on,
All
Charles.
right.
Have a great weekend, and we'll speak to you soon.
Okay, so let's have a look. It's time to review the 12 stocks of 2025, the 2025 picks. I mean, there are more than 12, but the main 12 were the first picks, and then we added a few every quarter, didn't we? So I think we got up to 18 in total. But let's start at the bottom of the list. I think the worst performer I see is Priority Intelligence. It's down at some 77%, which it's currently trading around the 2.7 pence mark. We've seen a glut of news from Priority Intelligence since they came to market at the back end of last year, but what do you think is driving down the momentum in share price?
Hasn't got a bid for some reason. It's worth more than this, I'm sure, but just I think it's been ignored, is my honest answer. Because the deals that they keep coming up with is going to make this company cash flow positive. They've got themselves the bitcoins, 5 bitcoin in those little tiny bits that are then going to be used to create more wealth. It's too cheap.
And then they had the news on the 26th of August that they had the admission to trading on the OTCQB venture market. Doesn't always mean that there's going to be a massive amount more volume increasing, but obviously it gives them the company's international presence and liquidity and access to the additional AI and digital asset savvy investors who may frequent the US markets. Other than that, obviously, they had the metric division announcement as well, the new data and AI-powered growth and partnership agency for the entertainment sector. And then obviously, they also announced the first clients, including the Brits and Sony, Celtic FC, Scottish Golf, and the Favela Cerveza beer company as well. So, yeah, I mean, let's see what comes up. Let's see if
that metrics thing is going to be much bigger than everybody thinks. I think everybody just thought that was a small announcement. But you look at it, if they start getting their AI product, and maybe it's only £200 to £500 per month in each event place, if you like. But just think, they've got Scottish Golf there. They've got a basketball thing throughout Europe. They've got, you know, it will be hundreds of people who will be taking this up. And that's going to create quite a lot of revenue. And that's before they upsell in all of those different situations. So I think if we get some announcements on some of those, they're going to be extremely good revenue producers over a large number of people who are going to be using those things. So I think it's a much bigger announcement than everybody thought. And yeah, the share price has been a disaster, let's be honest.
Okay, next one.
Next one's Tiger Royalties. Owns two subnets, is earning tau every day still, though not at a great rate. I'm sad to say Jonathan Bixby's gone completely quiet. There hasn't been any news for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. But it's putting its finger in many, many pies, and I can't see how it's not going to be worth significantly more. But right now, it's not doing anything, and hence the reason why it's 61% down since we recommended it. So, yeah, it
feels like it's gone radio silence. There was a lot of announcements, wasn't there, around the subnets and about the tau and all those sort of, you know, the emission. But then all of a sudden, it feels like they did the consolidation. It's obviously now trading around what would be old money, like 0.1 pence, I think, or 0.105.
Yeah.
But as you say, went up to the
0.5.
Would have been 0.5, which is 5 pence. So I'm just trying to understand why it's dropped back.
Yeah, I don't think there is any reason other than the lack of communication and actually just what's going on is my honest answer. I don't think the business has changed at all. It's changed its name now. So it's called Tiger Alpha now rather than Tiger Royalties. You know, the joke is it still holds all of the assets of the mining things that it has that Colin Bird had in there initially. So, I mean, as we see those mining stocks do well, the 250 grand's worth of mining stocks could easily be worth a couple of million quid if any of those go off. So, yeah, interesting.
Okay, next one, Charles, over to you. Amaroq Minerals down some 33%, trading around the 70 pence mark. What's going on?
Yeah, no stresses there. I mean, basically, the market is rational. It's fine. Wait it out for it to come back up and then go to new record highs. I mean, if you compare it, you know, from where we were at the start of the year to where we are now, they did a institutional placing at 81p, you know, significant 11p higher than where we are now, and raised, you know, tens of millions of dollars, which they're using to optimize and further improve their gold processing plant at Nalunaq. We're looking at this year 5,000 ounces of production, so nothing particularly special, but brokers are calling 36,000 ounces of production next year. 36,000 ounces times 3,500 or even $4,000 gold, and you're looking at, you know, $100, $150 million of revenue just from Nalunaq. You don't have the Black Angel mine, which they've acquired. And then the drilling, 8,500 meters of drilling, you know, exploratory assets, including Nanoq, where I think the grades are going to be spectacular when those get reported back. That's just speculation, but just based on what we know about all of that. The joint venture with ACAM/JCAM, and that's all exploring for critical minerals out there. You then have a CEO, Elder, was talking to Bloomberg a couple of months ago about, you know, US/European interest in investing in it. And we know that, you know, the US is very, very keen in particular on Greenland. So there's a lot of money floating around there. What do I think? I think that this is optimization year for the plant. And so you had a few people switch off. I think that by the end of the year, we'll have a solid recovery. And if not, then in 2026, it'll be explosive. I think the key thing is that with a lot of gold stocks have gone up massively. So now you have to look for where's the value going to be. And Rock's going to be one of the big winners. And
it's going to be a Greatland Gold 24-25 situation, I think.
I think it's going to shoot up. I think we'll be back at record highs kind of before you know it. Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, so currently 33% down, but actually in a better position than it was when it was 33% higher. So there you go, such is life.
Indeed.
The next one I chose as one of the ones during the year in Canthera. It's down 25%. Just hasn't had any news, to be honest. So we're waiting for news on sales and what's happening with the product. I actually got Kerpak as well when I got here to England. And I gave it to a few people that have used it in the last couple of days and said it's very nice, beautiful. Whether it works or not, we'll see as time goes by, but I'm pretty sure it does work because they've had lots of influences on it. I certainly think it's going to recover from this level over the next few months. And if it doesn't over the next few months, certainly over the next year and a bit, I have a great deal of faith in it. So there you go. What about Jubilee then, guys?
Yeah, I think Jubilee, I think it's down slightly, isn't it? But I mean, throughout the year, it's been up, it's been down. It's roughly traded, you know, within a range of where it started the year at. I think you have the situation now where they're disposing of the South African assets. And so it's becoming a higher risk, higher reward company. But if you have up to 90 million, you have $90 million in stage payments coming into the company. And then you have the assets on the ground in Zambia. I mean, this company is now massively, massively undervalued, putting the past aside. Just on, you know, the cash that's going to come in from the asset sale, plus the assets on the ground, forgetting the growth potential that you have there in Zambia. I think that if you look at the parcel of 2 or 3 years, there's been missteps, there's been errors, there's been unluckiness as well, particularly with regards to sort of metals pricing. But the bottom line is that they built the South African business up as they said they would. And if they can do it again in Zambia, but while owning all of the assets, then you're probably going to see a really good growth potential there. I would say kind of like my kind of closing comment on Jubilee is Leon has pretty much nailed his flag to the mast on Zambia now. If it's successful, then that's what he'll be remembered for. And I think he will be. I think that the assets they have out there are strong and the country really wants to deliver the copper. What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think that a lot of investors were kind of like, oh my word, you know, what are you doing selling the South African assets? But actually, it makes a lot of sense because you just don't, even that jurisdiction you could argue is maybe safer than Zambia. You just don't know what the government could do with the PGM and the chrome there. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. The Zambian, after having been to Roan and the Sable and all the different sites around there and even Munkoyo, the amount of copper in the ground that is you can physically see it around the weathering, you know, around all the reef, the potential for copper mining and production, and even having seen the actual copper cathodes being removed, I think they're better off, much better off focusing on the Zambian assets. Personally, I think it's a bold move, but I think it will be one that pays off.
I think my biggest thing with Jubilee is that over the years, it's always been dilution, right? That's what's happened, is that to pay for the growth, it's had to dilute you, but the share price has come down while it's been growing. If you're having this money coming into the company constantly, Leon's made very clear it's far more than what they actually need to develop the Zambian assets, then not only might you get things like dividends or share buybacks, right, cross your fingers, you're not going to have to worry about dilution when the share price starts recovering. I think that's absolutely key as well.
Yeah. Okay, next yeah. one. Sovereign Metals down some 13.5%. The trading around 31. This is a bit baffling, this one, I guess. Maybe perceived lack of news. There has been some news of late regarding the major boost for the Kasia Rutile Graphite project in Malawi, with Japan unveiling, I think it was a $7 billion initiative to develop the Nacala Logistics Corridor. The funding split between the African Development Bank and Japan's Development Agency is expanding capacity, upgrade infrastructure, and reducing the bottlenecks in Malawi. So I guess that backing from Japan for the country will just helps with the, you know, project economics and aligning with Japan's drive to secure long-term critical mineral supply chain. So other than that, has it gone quiet? I don't know. I mean, I guess they're aiming towards DFS and all those things, but
I think this is it. I think the key thing is that Rio Tinto is their institutional investor and owns very close to 20% of the stock. They can't go over 20 because, you know, takeover rules, blah, blah, blah. But Rio Tinto has, you know, got a new CEO who's potentially looking to divest the titanium unit. And therefore, your natural buyer of that asset, which is, you know, basically what the fingers crossed was, is up in the air. It's worth noting Rio's tried to sell off that titanium unit for a very long time and has never been able to find a buyer willing to pay their price. So it might be that they do the internal company review and decide they do want to keep the titanium unit. And then what do you want to have to make that titanium unit profitable? We want Kasia and we want to develop it because that hugely improves the profit margins because it's rutile. But I think that's kind of one part of it. The other part of it is that nobody is expecting there to be an asset sale until the DFS lands. And the DFS, you know, is going to be in Q4 this year. You know, DFS is tend to run over, but say you know, early Q1 at the latest, 2026, but most likely in Q4. And therefore, there's a lot of people who are going, well, we can just pull our money out and we'll just come back when that DFS lands and then hope for the asset sell. But I do think that the fact the World Bank was talking about it, you know, relatively recently as well, and the fact that Toho Titanium has validated the titanium use there, and the fact that, you know, the Japanese are putting billions of dollars into the development of the Nikkala corridor means that if Rio Tinto doesn't want to do it, then there's going to be a willing buyer in Japan out there, you know, waiting in the wings. So I think it's a really, really good steal.
Yeah, I mean, I would just to recap on both Sovereign and Jubilee, you know, these are bigger companies than some of the other stuff that we're dealing with, and not exploration, both going to be going into production. And I think if you want two solid plays, Sovereign and Jubilee, over the next 2 to 3 years, are going to pay you handsomely. I think Jubilee could be exponential growth, Sovereign also, simply because if it's not progressed by the major, I actually think it's a better investment for everybody involved, because I don't think they're going to have any problems with getting the money to do it. And it's a multi-generational project in the same way as Jubilee is as well, in terms of producing the copper, whether it be from the waste or from other things. It's going to be 50 plus years in both situations. So yeah, I think though they're both moderately down on the year, I'd be surprised if they're both down by the end of the year. Very surprised.
Well, I think the key thing with both of them is that, you know, they are slightly down, but they've also been up throughout the year. Like, there's not, you know, if we any of us went out and bought 20, 30 grand of stock on the market, you'd probably make it back to flat year to date, despite the size of the company, which is just mental. But that's the way the market works.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next one we've got on the list there, Phil, is Aterian. That was one I chose midway through the year. So it's down a bit. Trading arms going great guns, and I think they've got cracking assets. They've got great assets in Rwanda with a major. They've got good assets in Morocco with silver and copper, and they've got a cracking asset in the middle of Botswana, in the middle of all that shenanigans that's going on with Cobra. I think there's spending hundreds of millions in Botswana. So I just think it's a hidden gem, £4 million market cap. I mean, I can't see that it's not going to be worth significantly more.
Next one is one of
Asia Met.
Asian Met, yeah, Arse, the best ticker on the market, Arse. Tell us about Arse.
Asia Met, Asia Met, Asia Met. Yeah, I mean, the basic thing for me is up this year. I feel like might be up, might be down.
It's currently 2.2% down, but
That could be the spread. I mean, come
give
on.
me give me a minute. I'll buy 500 quid's worth and
You
we'll
might
be
be
up 5%.
Asia Met and Aterian are basically the spread. So that I have not, and even the next two, which is GreenX and Rome, basically the spread as well, even though
I
they're
think
physically up.
this is the thing, though, right? With a lot of these companies, like it's all, you know, if you're buying and selling in volume as well, you know, if you're 5% up for the year and you want to put a large sell on, you're actually down 10%. So it's probably the percentages we're using are maybe not as accurate as we think. But, you know, with Asia Met, again, in my view is, you know, it's almost certainly going to be an asset sale, if not a joint venture for BKM. We've got this turnkey project. They've done all of the work. There's a huge advantage being out there in Indonesia. They've got capital from a recent placing, and, you know, this is the thing. They hired Grant Samuel in July to be their financial advisor for, you know, strategic investor engagement, which is basically, you know, it's not complex. That's to, you know, joint venture or asset sale BKM, and they appointed Peter Oliver as their project director for the asset in August. So you have this situation where there's a copper supply crisis. You've got an asset which is turnkey, and they've done all the paperwork on it. And then you've got Peter and you've got Grant Samuel in the mix. So I think either we'll have an asset sale or a joint venture very, very soon. Hopefully by the end of this year. And then we'll hope you'll get 3 or 4p a share and potentially more, and we can all walk away happy. And that's the
Right off,
thesis.
right off into the sunset. Yeah,
Yes, indeed. You know, that's the idea anyway. That's the theory.
theory behind it. Okay, so next one, as Kev just alluded to, GreenX Metals up some four. Let's call it flat, but 4% anyway. We spoke to Sapangai last week on this, didn't we? What do you make of GreenX or the potential?
I think it's, you know, there's two parts to GreenX. You've got the litigation side of things, which I think is pretty much coming to a head. Like, the Polish government has lost the deal. It's can they delay it, salvage it, whatever? Highly unlikely. I think it's like 95% chance it's going to have to be paid. So that would basically be twice the market cap, I think, at the current price in terms of a payment. And then you've got now the potential to have a huge copper gold project in Central Europe in Germany, which effectively, as we were speaking, was a wartime thing that was created. They were going to mine it. the shaft's already sunk, as we saw when we went to see it. Phil.
It's almost like an Indiana Jones story, isn't it, really? That if you look
yeah.
at
it. You know, I don't know why it hasn't gone up more, actually, now that they've sort of announced that they've got this project. Because if you had this project just in its on itself without the litigation side of things, I think it would potentially be worth what the company's worth now anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's big, it's vast. And, you know, when you're talking about 1 million tons of contained copper, 2 million tons of contained copper, 3 million tons of contained copper, which is the size of these type of things that run into Poland as well in this strike, they're worth a lot of money. So yeah. I think over the next year or two, it will be proved that it's worth a lot of money. My indication would be if you buy GreenX today, it would be like you buying sovereign metals at between 5 and 10p. You know, you're going to see a big upside, I think.
Yeah, I think it's basically, ironically, there's no pun intended, it's arbitration between the share prices that would be with these assets at the stage they're at and the potential for that litigation settlement, which the company has said the vast majority, if not all of it, would just be issued as a special dividend when that's settled, which, you know, I think might be as early as Q1 next year. And you know, from like a legal, I can't, you know, no, I'm not allowed to talk from a legal perspective. From a practical perspective, if you look at the comments that have been made around that, you know, set aside motion, that's good. It seems that money is going to get paid out once we get to the end of this process. When that happens, there'll be a, you know, if there is a special dividend, the share price will drop accordingly, most likely. But then thereafter, I think you'll have a lot of investors who don't want to have exposure to that litigation, will then want to jump in, and you might find that it recovers very quickly as well.
Yeah.
Which could be quite fun.
Yeah, but that special dividend is probably likely to be higher than the share price itself is.
Oh, significantly. I think more like double what it is now. Yeah.
So, you know, I think you could be looking at the share price, you know, maybe halving, but you would have had twice the payout or 1.5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you could easily make 150% return and then still have this copper gold project on the go. So yeah, I think you've got all things covered. So I think we're now moving into a territory. I'll just recap on the overall as we go into the 2, 4, 6, 8, the top 8 stocks that we have. On average, the stocks are up 142% this year, which is like bananas. Yeah, obviously because one particular stock has done extremely well, which we'll come on to. But it just proves really that, you know, if you have one or two or three big winners, you're going to be successful in your investing journey. And I also want to bring people's attention to what our stocks were last year, because if you look now at 2024 stocks, which when we started the year were, I think, down about 7%, they're now up 35.4% on average. So if you just held what we'd said at the start of 2024 to now, you would now have 35.4% return on average. So that's not too shabby either.
Okay, so the next one is over to you, Charles, again, is Rome Resources.
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, I think we're up a little bit, but, you know, you're going to count it by the spread year to date. There was a pesky rebellion/war. You know, which is mostly resolved, but is a DRC, so nothing is ever fully resolved. But yeah, I mean, basically, we're going to have a maiden mineral resource estimate come out of that company next month, which I think is going to be absolutely fantastic. I don't think people realize, you know, just how much metal is contained in there. And that's the first catalyst. But the second catalyst, so IRH, which is a Middle Eastern, you know, powerhouse, is invested in the mine next door, which their key deposit, Busy, was discovered by the same exploration and management team, which is currently at Rome. IRH support hundreds of millions of dollars into this thing, and they have, you know, actually said that they want more ore feed for the mine. There's only one, you know, exploratory outfit out there who is going to be capable of delivering more feed, and that's Rome. So I would suspect, well, the buyout isn't coming anytime soon. I'd imagine that IRH will look to fund the next stage of exploration for Rome in the not too distant future, hopefully shortly after the MRE, and then you might find there's a nice tailwind to the end of the year, and we end the year on a high note.
Yeah, the question, Charles, is when war broke out, did you have the governance to increase your position in Rome?
Did you double down?
Doubled it. To be fair, I bought more of Alphamin than I did of Rome, because it's interesting, because when you look at the DRC, right, and I'm trying to think of the words, you talk about like political risk, but I've never seen the DRC steal a mine from anybody, right? which you have seen in other African jurisdictions. I've never seen the DRC massively increase your taxes, which destroys your profit margin. What you have is, the kind of the political violence, the rebels, M23, Rwanda, and all of that. But actually, the metal is exceptional, and the government is supportive by and large, even though it's quite far away. And so, yeah, I mean, even when we talked to Rick Rule, and I was asking him, I was like, I did put more money in at the bottom there, and he was saying the metal is still in the ground. You're going to retain those licenses once the fighting is dealt with, then it will recover, and it has done. Now, the one thing I would say is that I hold Rome as part of a diversified portfolio of companies. So you don't want to go all in on, basically on, conflict areas for obvious reasons. But the other thing is, if these assets were in Western Australia or Canada, for example, or Nevada, they'd be worth 10 times as much. So that political risk is baked into the share price. It's just part and parcel of the investment case.
Yeah, I think you've done very well with that one, to be honest with you, to be 5.88% up. And we understand that's only a rounding error in terms of the price. But considering we had basically shut down of the mine and exploration and war, then you've done pretty damn good, I think.
I think this is the thing, right? It's a siren call of the DRC geology. It's, you
Yeah.
can't. I think my key thing, I know he doesn't like to be named too much, but Klaus, our chairman over there, you need somebody who understands and is capable of managing the political risk and has
Yeah.
decades of experience to prove it. And that's not just the DRC, there's various other African jurisdictions where if certain names aren't involved, you stay away, and if they are, then it's worth the risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I spoke earlier then about the top eight, which were the ones that really have made reasonable gains. So in eighth place is Power Metal, which actually is just like a play on cash at the minute. If we're actually truly honest, having sold now the second part of their GMET shares. They've got a huge amount of cash. I've been speaking with Sean, so hopefully Sean's going to come on in the next couple of weeks. What's your thoughts overall now? Because it's a bit of a different company than it was a few months ago.
Well, obviously you've got the massive cash position, and at times throughout the year, the share price, the market capitalization of a company has been trading lower than the cash held on the balance sheet, right? It's I'm trying to think of the word. I mean, one of the big things of not just the cash position, just in general, is that Power, has kind of ignored the brokers for a couple of years. It's literally just, found a way to find cash or get cash invested without broker involvement. And obviously the share price is down, probably because there's been a seller in that stock for a while. And yet that seller must now be running on fumes. You have the situation where it's got obviously the FDR IPO, so that helps. It's got shareholding still in First Class Metals, which is a bit of a long shot, but it is there. Then got all the work in Saudi Arabia. You've got the seed funding for MineStarters, which I think, that blockchain-based technology could be a really, really clever investment. But I think the other thing basically is that Sean's now sitting on, even after paying for MineStarters and everything else, say 15 million quid,
Yeah.
What's his plans for it? Because he is very, from what I know of Sean, he's a smart chap, and he's methodical. He will have a plan for that money. So I think the biggest thing is, you're cashed up. You've got a market capitalization around the cash value in the company and all of the other things, and also the uranium drilling, obviously. What,
Yeah.
16 million upside? So it's a very low risk investment if you're going to buy now. And then with, catalytic upsides, various of them, including what's Sean going to do with all that cash.
Yeah, and they don't have to sell the things now. I mean, in the uranium side of things, they could be in a situation where they could put their own cash in and
Well,
to take
okay.
it to the next level if required.
Well, here's another thing is that, like we all know that if you want to stay listed on AIM, between lawyer fees and listing costs and salaries and whatever else, you're not getting that much change out of $1 million a year anymore. So if you've got 15 million quid, and say you've, I'm not saying Sean has, but say he has invested it even in money market funds paying 5%, when like a any kind of like index fund paying sort of 6-7%. You can cover your capital costs just from the returns on that cash held in the company balance sheet. How many other small caps, micro caps, can say that? Very few, I would say.
Yeah, well, I very much doubt we're going to get a raise in Power Metal, sorry, in the next while. You would hope.
Well, I think he was talking about, like, there was an RNS, I think it was today, yesterday. The days can't blend in for me nowadays, but, talking about, rearranging the capital structure, potentially for share buybacks. And I
Yeah.
think, to be honest, I think that's probably the best. Generally, I dislike but share buybacks because the message it sends to the market is we don't know what to do with this money. The best thing you can do is just give it back to investors, right? But in the case where your share price is trading below the cash in the company, it makes a hell of a lot of sense to buy those shares back because it's effectively free money. I mean, to run.
I think using 20, 25% of that money to buy shares back is going to be a very clever move, you know?
Yeah, if you look at the liquidity in the stock, if you you apply 3, 4 million pounds worth of buys, then you probably see a significant rise in the share price as well. So yeah.
And I think that, as you pointed out, I think that the mining technology thing that they've moved into, I think that could be, it could either be a masterstroke or it could be, oh, that didn't go so well. But if it is a masterstroke, the return on that could be very substantial.
Well, it's interesting because Sean also seeded, not seeded, but he put capital in Free Power Metal into GSAE, right? The recycling firm. And it's interesting because when you're talking about the merchant bank model, if you look at like across the US and Canada, when you like sell, when you profit from like an investment like with GMET, like Powell has done, and got, you know, millions and millions of pounds back, you then seed other companies, a diverse range of companies, fully expecting some of them to fail. Right, I think this is the thing. Some of them will fail, but if one or two of them do extremely well, then you know you've paid it off, and you everything's fantastic.
Well, GMET's been the success, hasn't it? And it's paid for
Yeah.
everything, basically. So it's all good.
Oh.
Okay, so next one is Greenrock. I think that was one of yours, Phil.
Yeah.
And what's been happening? It was up more than 100% at one point. Now it's up 51%. But I mean, give
Yeah,
us
I mean,
your thoughts.
there's an update at the back end of July, so there hasn't really been much since then. But basically, just talking about an update on the Amit SOC, where they talked about the bulk sampling program, which commenced around the middle of August. And then obviously they looked at the environmental baseline studies, which commenced on the 28th of July. But since then, there really hasn't been a, I guess it's all hands to the deck there, working through the field program as detailed in the RNS that came out at the end of July. Yeah, just waiting results from some of the bulk sampling, etc. So yeah, all good. Field program's progressing. That's all I know really.
Good. Okay, well, let's move on to the next one. We now move on to our 2, 4, 6 companies that have bagged or more that we've picked, which is pretty impressive. Six of the original 12 have now done more than 100%. So the first one is Bezant, which has done, I think, around 120%. Yeah, how it hasn't done more, I cannot fathom. Okay, because probably a year away at tops from mining and having free cash flows of $20, $25 million a year, and then extending that situation, it needs funding, and I think on funding it will go berserk, is my
Yeah.
simple answer. What do you think, Charles?
Well, I think the Blackstone Minerals shareholding that they have already is covers a significant part of the market cap, even after the rise. I think that's the first thing to say. And there's demand for those shares as well. So if they want to offload them, I know that
Well,
there'll be
they
buyers.
have recently. They
They
chipped
have
away a
their
few,
a
didn't
few
they?
of
There's
them
only
live
5
there.
million. They got 179 grand. So you could argue that it's paying for working cap, just chipping away at them, and they've
Yeah,
still got a
yeah.
massive position.
They sold a few of them, but as in there is, you know. When Macquarie did the raise for Blackstone not so long ago, there were like I know that there would have, you know, at that point Bazan could have sold those shares off. They wanted to keep hold of them. The demand is still there for that stock if they want to get rid of it. That's the first thing. There's a li that's liquid stock. You know, you're going to be able to sell them very close to the current Blackstone share price should you choose to. Now the second thing is, you know, they've got this plant now which they acquired a couple months ago. Maybe even sooner, more recently. And you just have the situation now where you just need financing sorted. They can build the plant up and running 6, 9 months. And then, I mean, I did an article, what, 6, 7, 8 months ago before this huge rise, I was talking about, you know, the profit margins of free cash flow. You're looking at free cash flow from the open pit alone of like $30 million a year. It's probably closer to 60 million now, the way copper and gold has gone. So, yeah, I think it will only keep going up. And the other thing is, what's attractive to me is this is an asset in Namibia, which is jurisdiction going in Africa is really strong, really stable. Yeah, good.
And I think there's more gold there than actually they're allowed to say.
Yeah, it possibly is. I don't know. Next
So,
up.
next one, another one that, and I was the lucky one to choose it, I think, but I think you know more about it than I do, is Greatland Resources, currently up 135%. You know, when we talked about Greatland Resources or didn't have a great 2024, but then when we picked it at the start of 2025, it went on a massive run. I can see the same thing happening with Amaroq, maybe towards the end of this year and next year. But Greatland, what do you think? I think there's been fun and games in Australia, but what do you think is going to happen going forward?
I don't really want to get sued, to be honest, because if I say it publicly, I probably will be, but no, I'm not going to. Basically, what I will say is that if you compare the position, for example, of Greatland Resources now to comparators like Genesis, right, which I did recently, Greatland is superior and also on almost every metric, and yet is significantly undervalued compared to Genesis by market capitalization. So on a fundamental basis, it should rise. And if it doesn't rise, Greatland will just, profit lots from a gold it's digging out of the ground and then develop Havieron, and then you'll just get massive dividends every year until it does. The one thing I can't understand, and I'm not going to talk about sort of past potential manipulation, but the Greatland has been accepted to the ASX 200, and that's as of Monday. It will be trading on the ASX 200. So I'm not talking about active funds that can do whatever they want, but passive funds should have been buying really significant amounts of Greatland over the past couple of weeks. So you should have seen the share price go up kind of dramatically, and it just hasn't happened. That volume isn't there, and yet it technically should be. I'm trying to figure out why that is the case. And it beats me. I don't know. I have no idea. So if anyone has any ideas, please let me know. But
this is on a postcard.
These are passive funds, right? So they have to buy the stock to maintain the parity with the index. They have to buy stock in Greatland. They don't have a choice as a passive fund, much like the FTSE 100 or the S&P 500. No one's making a choice. It's just passively tracking. So yeah. Why is there no buying in the stock for those funds?
Do you think maybe that they have a leeway, as in they have a quota to get themselves up to the
generally,
level?
Generally, no. Mm. No. Active funds can do whatever they want. If you talk about the GDXJ, for example, when Greatland was on just on AIM, then they had a lot of leeway to do what they wanted. And even with Greatland on the ASX, again, because it's actively managed, regardless of whatever anyone will tell you, that there is a lot of leeway around what you can do. Whether there should be or not is a different thing, but it is actively managed. With the passive funds, it shouldn't be. It should be, we will sell some of the stock in shares that have left this, and some of the stock in other things in the index, and then buy Greatland shares, plus the other stocks in the index that have been promoted. So I don't know what's going on. I have no idea.
Okay. It's still up 135%.
Yeah, you can't complain. You can't complain if you want to start the year. Yeah.
Okay. So the next one, I think, was your choice, Charles, and that is Guardian Metal Resources, up 172% since recommended at the end of the year.
Yeah, not too shabby, right? For me, 172. I mean, I invested in this one at sort of 8.5p a couple of years ago. That's more than a 10 bag announcer. Very happy. But I think this is the thing, right? It's sovereignty of metals, right? And particularly supply chains for metals. The Americans need a domestic source of tungsten. There is only one real domestic source of tungsten out there in America, and Guardian Metal is sitting on top of it. Ergo, the massive share price rise. And the fact you now have Stanley Druckenmiller's, a firm controlled by him, taking on that Power Metal shareholding. And, and short of, I don't know, the genie from the lamp, Stanley's pretty much the best person you could possibly ask to invest in it. Now, we could talk about technicals and all of that stuff, but basically, you had the DoD grant funding. There's probably more in the pipeline. And literally just yesterday, was it? The all of Guardian Metals was sitting down next to, what's his face? Jabby.
Luknik,
there we go. The Commerce in the United States. So you're kind of sitting there, you're going, well, they're rubbing shoulders with the highest guys in the land. They're sitting on top of the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States. They've also got Tempo-Eat, which is, again, a massively important producing mine, or it used to be before tungsten prices collapsed. But I think the bigger story here is, I'm trying to think of the words, the bigger story here is that China has an iron grip over metals and minerals. And if you can identify the ones that China is going to prevent the US and Europe from acquiring, just find the assets that, will respond to that and go for it, So we take Sovereign with titanium, for example, is a good example. But there's also tin assets out there, and tantalum assets, all the T's, basically. And the uranium as well. There are assets out there which are going to do just as well as Guardian and possibly more.
So how much further do you think GMEC can go? I mean, this is a question I'm asking myself. It's like, a lot of people, when they were investing 8p, 10p, 12p, 15p, even 20p, 30, 40p, if this gets to a pound, I'm out, but actually, or certainly taking a lot of money off the table. The reality of the situation is, I think the company has now the potential to be much bigger than we all anticipated.
Well, if you can be the first to be producing tungsten and delivering it, on a domestic capacity capability, and you have the DoD setting up stockpiles pretty much adjacent to your mines in Nevada, then if you can then consolidate and buy more and more tungsten producing land and become the tungsten major in the US, sure. I think the chances are, once you get to a point at which you're producing, buyer offers will start to come in, and then I think it's kind of inevitable. Because the opportunity is there, and I just think a major would rather deliver it rather than anybody else. Now, the bigger question is, if you're holding stock now at sort of 80, 90p or whatever it is at the moment, if an offer came in, what would you be happy to accept? And the interesting thing is that you don't actually have any choice. You don't get to choose that, because the stock is held by ACAM and by Sammy Druckenmiller and by a handful of insiders. So actually retail, part of the reason why the stock has risen so high is because most of it is held in very tight institutional hands. And so when that offer does come, you can vote if you want to, but the majority vote will be taken by the institutions, and it will probably be a reasonable premium.
So Stanley went in at 55p.
Mm.
What sort of return does he normally insist on?
The thing is with Stanley, what I've noticed with him is that he doesn't he buys first and researches later. If you look at like his researching, his investing history, he goes, well, GMAT is, this tungsten story is moving, we should buy into this now and then research later. I imagine I don't know. I think this is the thing, I don't actually know. It depends. If somebody comes along now and says, right, we'll offer you £2 a share for the whole lot, would you be a fool to not take it? Or do you think it can grow higher? I mean, we have a broken note saying £3, don't we, out there?
No, I mean, if he's only been in for 3 months and he got 300 or 400%, he'd be very happy, I would imagine.
Well, exactly. And I think there's this sort of, particularly with high net worth investors, particularly with family offices, you kind of forget that, like, if the average annual return in like a average portfolio is sort of 6 or 7 or 8% a year, right? So if you're beating that, then you're doing exceptionally well. If you make a few hundred percent, in a year, you should be over the moon.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so let's move on. The next two choices in third place as we speak. The next two are actually Phil's choices. Cobra Resources.
I'm getting good at this, aren't I?
232.
Let's not mention the first one we talked about.
This cancels that out, though. Don't worry, Charles.
Yeah,
so the next one's Cobra Resources. What is it up, Kev?
232% year to date. It was actually higher than that. It's come back a bit.
It's come off the ball. But someone just paid 4p now as we're on the call, so that's good. Yeah, so they've had a couple of bits of news. They're actually not too shy on the news, actually. They had the announcement to acquire the significant copper project at the back end of August. But in recent weeks, they've talked about the metallurgical study, which supports even the lower cost recoveries. Then this week, they also had the announcement that the large-scale rare earth ISR system potentially extends beyond Boland as well. And I think that was on the newly acquired tenements on the 6742, 6774 and 6780, expanding that resource potential of Boland across two regionally extensive paleochannel systems. So that was really well received. And then on Thursday of this week, they also noted that they got the environmental approval for Boland infill studies. And then they announced an update on the scaled column ISR test. So really no shortage of news from Cobra in the last kind of couple of months. And I think that's just helping that really nice steady news flow where it's keeping the share price momentum going. It's what companies need, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's done a fantastic job, to be honest. Absolutely fantastic. Can't see that it won't continue either. It's still a small capitalization in terms of the company, and the resource size has increased. They've started to do other things as well. So yeah, it's very good. So yep. while you're in glory, Immu Pharma currently up 258%, was up over 400%.
Yeah, I mean, it went up to sort of 18, 20 pence mark or something.
I think it hit 19 at its absolute peak.
Yeah.
But right now it's trading 11.25, up 258% since you tipped it, just over 3p, I think it was. So yeah, give us your thoughts.
And again, really, I mean, I think we covered it in when we talked to Tim and obviously Sebastian about a month ago. There really hasn't been a massive amount of news since the beginning of September. I think so. We're effectively 2 weeks now. There was a couple of RNSs regarding exercise of warrants, but really, this is moving on the back of the patent application, which was filed for P140, and also obviously the appointment of the CSO in Sebastian and also the head of R&D. So again, I think the momentum's there. I think everybody likes the fact that they've got this amazing, you know, patent application for P140. And, you know, look at the performance of a lot of biopharma plays over the last. We've seen Renalytics up on the week. Some, I think they were up about 40-50% as well. We've seen Hemogenics as well, had an amazing run. Yeah, in fact, Renalytics up about 30% on Friday's trading. Really, really good. Genflow have also moved up as well. Not a similar play, but a different sort of area on longevity. But yeah, I love to see some of these beaten down sort of pharma plays really reacting.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think we have the crypto treasury plays and all the liquidity that came to the market from that to, you know, thank partially for those rises. And, you know, it kind of gave the market kind of a shot of adrenaline that we've been needing for a long time. And then it becomes self-sustaining as well, because you've noticed, particularly in the pharma plays, like every week one is shooting up, and then the next one shooting up, and the next one shooting up, and people asking what the next one might be. Yeah. That's what the market's been missing for a couple of years. I think with Immunopharma as well, it's the fact that the company, you know, has indicated very strongly they're looking to commercialize P140 very, very soon. And when you come to commercialization, particularly with pharma majors, which is what Tim was talking about, you don't just get sort of milestones and royalties, which are all very exciting and obviously important. It's effectively the down payment on the day that you sign. You know, and that could be, you know, very, very market moving for Immunopharma.
Yeah, and I think there is one bucking the trend on there, that which is Futura Medical FUM. They've gone a bit limp on us, pardon the pun. But yeah, I mean, they dropped 50% on Friday on that news. But yeah, I mean, I guess there is always going to be an outlier in that area. But I think that was based on pretty terrible results from what
I think the thing is, our lead asset, Eroxon, right, which is for erectile dysfunction. Basically, what they're saying is that they haven't sold enough, so, you know, current stock is enough, and therefore they don't need to make more. Yeah. So the sales, but all you have to do, right? A lot of company research is really difficult. All you have to do with that one is just go on boots.com and read the reviews.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know? And virtually everyone just said it doesn't work.
Okay, all right. So on to the final one, Kev. Do you want to announce the drum roll?
So the gold medal, as it stands, is masked. 1,830% up.
Nearly a 20 bagger then. Well, it has been a 20 bagger.
It was a 30 bagger at one point when it was over the £2 mark. Fell back very significantly and then has come back again. So I actually think it's going to keep going. I mean, we've obviously heard what Peter had to say earlier on. I think it's a very exciting space, the AI centers. Yeah. I mean, it's not going to do 1,830% more, but I can easily see it'll be a 20-plus bagger by the end of the year. That would be miraculous. And I mean, ultimately, you're looking at that and saying, as an overall basket of investments, would you be happy with 142% year-to-date?
I mean, with the spread, it's more like 141. But yeah, I'd say that's not too shabby.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? And I mean, I think, you know, looking at all of those stocks, none of us really think that there isn't more upside in pretty much all of them. Mm. You know, I haven't thought, you know, and maybe we're being too positive, but I don't think so. I think there's upside in all of them. Right. I didn't tell you this, guys, but you get one shot, one more stock for the rest of this year. What is it? Charles, we're giving you the first choice.
I know what Charles is going to pick, so it's obvious, but go on.
Oh, dear. You don't know. You don't know everything about me. I might say Tesco. I'm not going to say Tesco. Tesco, no. What's mine going to be? Do you know what? It's got to be Defence Holdings.
Right? I've already written it down.
You can write it down.
Exactly.
Now, we're already up a gazillion percent. So, you know.
No, we're only up a couple of 100%. It's not a gazillion.
Well, you might be. I've not. Anyway, it's not important. The point is, we, our guys in Defence Holdings, were sitting in the same room as Jensen from NVIDIA yesterday, as he announced his like massive, massive funding into the United Kingdom. Our chief technology officer, who's developing our two products in conjunction with the MOD and Whitespace, Was the co-founder of Microsoft Ventures, which is the startup capital fund for Microsoft. Our chairman is the most senior military officer in the land, and we're still stuck around this 2p mark. I just think that the contextual clues, the amount of work going into it, the people that we have there. I was saying a month ago when we were sort of just kind of getting started with this that we're on the ground floor, we're on the first floor now. This is Sovereign AI. I mean, the basic thing for me, what attracted me to it was the Trailblazer theme, right? Because when Helium One did that kind of massive rise off the Tanzanian helium that they found, and then loads of helium stocks kind of jumped in and they kind of diluted it a bit because people jumped into various helium stocks. And then it was the same with the Bitcoin treasury companies, right? Because Smarter Web might still be trading where it was if the others hadn't started up, because the others, effectively cannibalize the capital. With this company of Sovereign AI, you need to have a hyperscaler. I believe Defense Holdings is Google, so that's not confirmed. We have a hyperscaler. You need to have somebody who can create that level of technology. We have that in Andy, who is, he could walk into any Mag 7 company and get a C-suite job tomorrow. And then on top of that, you need to be able to develop the products in partnership with the MOD, which we are. So yeah, I mean, for me, I think the upside potential is enormous still from here. And yeah, that's my next pick.
Very good, Charles. Okay, Phil.
I think I'm going to have to go for. We talked about how good pharma plays have been, and I think this one is still very much undervalued. We've spoken to Anthony Tennyson, the
He's going to
CEO.
choose my
Oh, mate. So, well, you gave me the option to go before you, mate. So we're going with Sovonis Therapeutics. No surprise there, really. I think that they've obviously they secured this exclusive CNS collaboration. That was announced at the back end of August for the CNS disorders there. And Professor Nutt obviously working with them there under the revised terms. They're obviously in this neuropsychopharmacology. I mean, some of the technology in here, and we've obviously talked at length with Anthony. It'd be good to get David Nutt on as well at some point and talk through some of the technologies behind it. But yeah, I mean, Charles, you've explained it really, really well in the past. Some of the products for, for alcohol use disorder, for post-traumatic stress disorder, and their sort of various range of products, your SVN-001, SVN-002. I think at like 20 million market cap, it is really, really, good value. They're obviously working with the NHS for those trials. They've got phase three for the AUD in Europe and the UK, and obviously preparing for phase 2B in the US, targeting the moderate to severe AUD. So I like the technology, and I think it's got massive potential.
I think the particular thing with Sovereigns for me, other than the fact that the trials are going on literally a stone's throw from my house, is that it's incredibly cheap to do these phase three trials compared to any other phase three trial, because it's a combination of talking therapy, but also repurposing ketamine, which is, a drug that's already used elsewhere. So those two things make it incredibly cheap, but also the chance of success much higher. And the other thing is that, so in phase two studies for 001 were massively more successful than the current standard of care. So even if phase three isn't as successful as phase two, it will still be ma significantly better than doing the current standard of care.
Okay, so my pick, and I had two actually, and I was umming and ahhing on which one I was going to do, and that was between Sovonis and Buccaneer Energy. The reason why I've chosen Buccaneer Energy is because it's simple as simple can be. Okay, it is get low cost oil production onshore in Texas. We get the barrels increasing, the share price is going to increase, and I think over the next 2 to 3 years, this could be a 20 bagger plus, is my view. I think, speaking of Paul, he's done this before. It's not, he's not like granny suck eggs times. He knows what he's doing.
He did it at
And
SDX, didn't he?
yeah, it did SDX, though he had tailwinds at SDX, whereas this time I think he's not going to have the same issues. He knows the place, he knows what's going on, and I'm pretty sure he's going to come up with some deals. And those deals are going to mean that ultimately Buccaneer Energy is going to be worth a hell of a lot more than 2.5 million pound market cap. So that's my pick, and I'm pretty sure it'll be one of my picks for next year as well, because I can't see how it's not going to progress. And it's simple, simple, simple. They're going to use the gas to produce Bitcoin as well, but that's a cherry on top. Don't let that distract you. The reality is increase the barrels of oil per day, and Bob's your uncle, they make more money. End of.
Very good. End of. All right, well, that was a bit of a marathon roundup, but always good to go through, though, the list of stocks, and obviously, a bit of an impromptu grab another, which we've all done there. Thank you to Charles for appearing. Always good to hear your insights, Charles. And and if you like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon for any future notifications of further episodes, and have a great weekend, all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.